now on sentry duty on his bench. He won't go in, but he's never far away. What does Bernard lose if the development goes ahead? She would have to speak to him at some point, or, perhaps better, ask Ron and Ibrahim to speak to him, which might mean tiptoeing around Joyce. He hasn't played chess in a long time, Bogdan. That was nice to see. He is good. He was a tough player for me. They have reached the iron gates of the Garden of Eternal Rest. Bogdan pushes one of them open and guides Elizabeth through into the cemetery. You must be quite a player yourself.
Chess is easy,
says Bogdan, continuing the walk between the lines of graves and now flicking on a torch.
Just always make the best move.
Well, I suppose, says Elizabeth, I've never quite thought about it like that. But what if you don't know what the best move is?
Then you lose.
Bogdan leads her on for a few more paces before stopping by an old grave in the top corner.
You said, I can trust you, okay?
Says Bogdan.
Implicitly, says Elizabeth.
Even though you are really called Elizabeth because I see bills in the study.
Sorry, says Elizabeth. But other than that, implicitly.
Is okay, whatever you need to do. But if I show you something, you don't tell the police. You don't tell no one.
You have my word.
Bogdan nods. You sit while I dig.
It is a pleasant evening to sit on the steps of a statue of Jesus Christ, and Elizabeth watches very happily as Bogdan, over to her left, starts digging the grave in the faint torchlight. She wonders what he might have uncovered. What secret was he about to reveal? She goes through the possibilities in her head. The most obvious answer was money. There would be a suitcase or a canvas sports bag, and Bogdan would heave it out and lay it at her feet. Banknotes, gold perhaps, a haul, buried by goodness knows who and goodness knows when. And a big haul, too. Or why has Bogdan dragged her up here in the middle of the night? Enough for someone to kill for. A couple of thousand, and surely Bogdan would just have taken it? Finders keepers, no harm done, but a suitcase full of 50s, well, that would...
Okay, you come see, says Bogdan, standing in the grave, spade now over his shoulder.
Elizabeth pushes herself up, walks over to the grave, and sees what Bogdan saw the morning that Ian Ventham was murdered. She supposes that of all the things to find in a grave, a body should be the least surprising. But as Bogdan's torch plays over the bones and the coffin lid on which they rest, she has to admit this wasn't what she had been expecting.
You thought money, right? Says Bogdan. Maybe I found some money or something and didn't know what to do.
Elizabeth nods. Money or something, Bogdan is very good.
I know, sorry, no money. Would have been good. Instead, bones inside the coffin. Other bones, different bones, outside the coffin.
And you found these yesterday, Bogdan? Asks Elizabeth.
Just when Ian was killed, yes, I didn't know what to do. I wanted a day to think. Maybe it's nothing, do you think?
I'm afraid it's probably something, Bogdan, says Elizabeth.
Yes, maybe is something, agrees Bogdan glumly.
Elizabeth sits now and dangles her feet into the grave. She looks down on the lid of the coffin. So, you opened the coffin?
I thought 'twas best to check.
Quite right, agrees Elizabeth. And you're sure it's a different body in there? Bogdan jumps into the grave and pulls away part of the coffin lid, exposing the bones inside.
Yes, bones where bones should be, much older. Elizabeth nods and thinks, so, two bodies, one where it belongs and another, much newer, where it doesn't belong.
Yes, maybe I should have told police, but I don't know. You know how police are.
I do know, Bogdan. You did the right thing coming to me. At some point we might need to talk to the police, but not yet, I think.
So what we do?
Fill it back in, Bogdan, if you wouldn't mind, just for the time being. Give me some thinking time.
I dig, I fill in, I dig, I fill in, whatever you need until the job is done, Elizabeth.
We are birds of a feather, Bogdan, says Elizabeth, thinking she must call Austin. He'll know what to do with all this. She looks down towards the lights of the village, mostly off now, but Ibrahim's light is shining bright. He'll be working away, good man. She looks back at Bogdan, shoveling earth into the grave, covered in dirt and sweat, sliding a broken coffin lid back over one body while carefully avoiding disturbing another body. She thinks this is absolutely the sort of son she would have liked to have had. Chapter 66.
They are bang at it all the time, says Ron. Always have been. Whatever it is, the Catholic Church will have a piece of it.
Even so, says Ibrahim. Ibrahim and Ron are discussing who might have murdered Ian Ventham. They are working their way through the list of 30 names, weighing up the possibilities. It is just the boys this evening. Joyce has Joanna staying and Elizabeth was nowhere to be found, which at this time of the evening was suspicious, but they have chosen to carry on regardless. Ron is insisting on marking everyone out of 10, and the more whiskey he drinks, the higher his scores are climbing. Maureen from Larkin had just scored a 7, largely because she had once pushed in front of Ron at dinner, which spoke 1,000 words. Father Mackey's our first 10. Ipsy, write it down. Top of the list. He'll have something buried up in one of the graves. Guaranteed, nailed on. Gold or a body or pawn. All three knowing that lot. He's worried they'll dig it up.
Seems unlikely, Ron, says Ibrahim.
Well, you know what Sherlock Holmes said, old son. If you don't know who did it, then something or other.
Indeed, wise words, says Ibrahim. And Father Mackey wouldn't just have dug it up himself, Ron, at some point, to save himself the worry?
Lost his spade, I don't know. Mark my words, though, says Ron, those very words beginning to slur gently and warmly. Late nights, whiskey, something to solve. This was the life. It's a 10 from me.
This is not strictly come poisoning, Ron. Ibrahim strongly disagrees with Ron's marking system, but writes 10 next to Father Mackey's name. As it happens, Ibrahim also strongly disagrees with the Strictly Come Dancing scoring system, believing it gives too much weight to the public vote when compared to the judges' scores. He once wrote a letter to this effect to the BBC and received a friendly but non-committal reply. He looks at the next name on the list. Bernard Cottle, Ron. What do we think there?
Another of the big guns for me.
The ice in Ron's whiskey chimes as he gestures with his glass.
See how he was that morning.
He has become increasingly agitated, I agree.
And we know he sits up there a lot on that bench like he's marking his territory, says Ron. Used to sit there with his wife, didn't he? So, that's where he gets his peace, isn't it? You can't take that away from a man, especially our age. Too much change don't sit right.
Ibrahim nods.
Too much change, yes. There comes a time when progress is only for other people. For Ibrahim, one of the beauties of Cooper's Chase was that it was so alive, so full of ridiculous committees and ridiculous politics, so full of arguments, of fun and of gossip. All the new arrivals, each one subtly shifting the dynamic. All the farewells, too, reminding you that this was a place that could never stay the same. It was a community, and in Ibrahim's opinion, that was how human beings were designed to live. At Cooper's Chase, any time you wanted to be alone, you would simply close your front door, and any time you wanted to be with people, you would open it again. If there was a better recipe for happiness than that, then Ibrahim was yet to hear it. But Bernard had lost his wife and showed no signs of finding a way through his grief. And so he needed to sit on Fairhaven Pier or on a bench on a hill, and nobody ever needed to ask why. "Where is your place, Ron?" asks Ibrahim. "Where do you find your peace?" Ron purses his lips and chuckles. "If you'd asked me a question like that a couple of years ago, I'd have laughed and left, wouldn't I?" "You would," agrees Ibrahim. "I have successfully changed you." "I think," starts Ron, face alert, eyes alive. "I think," Ibrahim sees Ron's face relax as he decides to just let the truth come out rather than think. "Honestly, I'm flicking through it all in my head. All the things you're supposed to say, but listen, it might be here in this chair with my mate drinking his whiskey, dark outside, with something to talk about." Ibrahim knots his hands together and lets Ron talk. "Just think of everyone who isn't here, Ibsy. Every bugger who didn't make it. And here we are, a boy from Egypt and a boy from Kent, and we made it through it all. And then someone in Scotland made us the whiskey. That's something, isn't it? This is a place, isn't it, old son? This is a place." Ibrahim nods and agrees. His place of peace is actually the wall of files directly behind him. But he doesn't want to spoil the moment. Ron has stopped talking, and Ibrahim can see he has gone somewhere very deep inside himself, lost to memories. Ibrahim knows to keep quiet, to let Ron go where he needs to go, to think what he needs to think. Something Ibrahim has seen so many times over the years, with people in that very armchair. It is his favourite thing about his job, seeing someone go deep inside themselves to access things they never knew were there. Ron tilts his head up. He is ready to talk again. Ibrahim leans forward, just a touch. "Where has Ron just been?"
"Do you think Bernard is banging Joyce, Ibsy?" says Ron. Ibrahim leans back just a touch. "I haven't really thought about it, Ron."
"Course you have, I know you have, psychiatrist. I bet he is, lucky sod, all that cake and what have you.
Could you still, you know, if you had to?" he asks.
"No, not for a few years now."
Same. A blessing in some ways. I was a slave to it. Anyway, I'd say he's a 9, wouldn't you, old Bernard? He was there. You could see he doesn't want the place bulldozed, and he worked in science or something, didn't he?
Petrochemicals, I think.
There you are, then. Fentanyl. 9.
Ibrahim is inclined to agree. Bernard does not seem to be living entirely in grace. He writes a 9 next to Bernard Cottle's name.
"Of course, if they are banging, Joyce won't like that 9, says Ron.
Joyce has the same information that we have. She will already know he's a 9.
She's no fool, that one, agrees Ron.
What about that girl from the top of the hill, the farmer's girl with the computers?
A Karen Playfair, says Ibrahim.
She was there, eh? Says Ron. Bang in the middle of it. Probably knows a thing or two about drugs. Pretty, too, and that's always trouble.
Is it?
Always, says Ron. To me, anyway.
Motive? Asks Ibrahim.
Ron shrugs.
Affair?
Forget graveyards. It's usually an affair.
A 7, perhaps, says Ibrahim.
Or perhaps a 7 with an asterisk and a footnote explaining that the asterisk means in need of further investigation.
Asterisk 7, agrees Ron, though with a pronunciation of the word asterisk very much his own.
And that just leaves the 4 of us, eh? The only ones left on the list.
Ibrahim looks down at the list and nods.
Shall we? Asks Ron.
You think there is a chance one of us did it?
Oh, I didn't do it, that's for sure, says Ron. They can redevelop what they like, more the merrier, far as I'm concerned.
And yet you led the objections at the public meeting. You lobbied the council and you started the barricade, all designed to stop the redevelopment.
Of course, says Ron, as if his friend has lost his mind. No one takes liberties with me.
And when else do you get the chance to cause a bit of trouble when you're nearly 80? But, mate, think of the service charge. The new facilities probably won't happen now. No way I'd have killed him. That'd be cutting off my nose. Score me a 4.
Ibrahim shakes his head. You get a 7. You are very combative. You are hot-headed, often irrational. You were there at the heart of the scuffle and you are insulin-dependent. So you know how to use a needle. That adds up.
Ron nods, fair enough.
All right. Let's call me a 6.
Ibrahim taps his pen against his book 7 times before looking up.
And your son, I think, perhaps, knew Tony Curran a little. Which adds up to 7.
Ron is no longer in his place of peace and his ice cubes now dance a different jig. He remains quiet, if not calm.
Don't bring Jason into this, Ibrahim. You know better than that.
Interesting, thinks Ibrahim, but says nothing.
Are we scoring ourselves, Ron, or are we not scoring ourselves?
Ron stares at his friend for a long while.
We are, you're right. Well, if I'm a 7, then you're a 7 too.
That's fine, says Ibrahim and writes it in his book. Any reason?
So many reasons, mate, Ron thinks. He is smiling now, the tension broken. Too smart by half, there's one. You might want to write these down. You're a psychopath or sociopath, whichever one the bad one is. Terrible handwriting, that's a sure sign. You're an immigrant, and we've all read about them. There's some poor British psychiatrist, a white fella, sitting at home without a job because of you. Also, perhaps you're furious that your hair is thinning. People have killed over less.
My hair isn't thinning, says Ibrahim.
Ask Anthony about my hair. He admires it. You were right there, right in the thick of it, as usual, and you're exactly the sort of person in a film who would commit the perfect murder just to see if he could get away with it.
That is certainly true, agrees Ibrahim.
Played by Omar Sharif, adds Ron.
Ah, so we agree I have hair.
Okay, I am a 7. Now, Joyce and Elizabeth. Ibrahim relishes the thought of talking late into the night. Once Ron goes, all there will be to do is read, to make more lists, then force himself to lie on his bed, waiting for a sleep that always takes too long to come. Too many voices wanting his attention, too many people still lost in the dark, asking for his help. Ibrahim knows he is usually the last person awake in Cooper's Chase, and tonight he is glad to have the excuse of company. Two old men fighting against the night. Ibrahim opens his pad again and looks out of his window towards Joyce's flat. Darkness everywhere. The village is asleep. Of course, Elizabeth is too much of a professional to let her torch beam show on her walk back down the hill. Chapter 67. Jason Ritchie sits at a corner table finishing his lunch, monkfish and pancetta, both locally sourced. He doesn't know quite what to do. Jason is surprised by the changes in the Black Bridge. It is now a gastropub called Le Pont Noir, with its name written black against grey in minimalist lowercase font. Some of the rough edges have been really knocked off Fairhaven over the years. Some of the darker corners have gone. You and me both, Jason thinks as he sips his sparkling water. Jason is thinking about the photograph. He would feel a lot safer with a gun. And 20 years ago, that would have been easy. He would have walked into the Black Bridge, talked to Mickey Lansdowne, who would have rung Jeff Goff, and, before he'd finished his pint, a kid on a BMX would have delivered a brown parcel to the saloon bar and been given a packet of crisps and 20 B&H for his troubles. Simpler times. Now Mickey Lansdowne was in Wandsworth for arson and for selling fake Viagra at car boot fairs. Jeff Goff had tried to buy Fairhaven Town FC, lost his money in a property crash, made another fortune selling stolen copper, and had eventually been shot dead on a jet ski. And did kids even ride BMXs anymore? The photograph lies in front of Jason on the table, taken in the Black Bridge long ago, in the days before pancetta and sourdough bread. The gang. Just like it was yesterday, laughing away like trouble wasn't round the next corner. Ever since he sat down, Jason has been trying to work out exactly where in the pub Tony Curran had shot that drug dealer down from London, trying his luck in sleepy Fairhaven. In about 2000, was it? It was hard because they had moved a wall, but he thinks perhaps it was by the reclaimed fireplace, with the locally sourced logs. Coffee, sir? The waitress. Jason orders a flat white. Jason remembers that the bullet had gone through the guy's stomach, straight through the paper-thin wall and out into the car park, where it went through the front wing of Turkish Gianni's Cosworth RS500. Gianni was gutted, you could see it, but it was Tony, so what could he do? Turkish Gianni. Jason has been thinking about him a lot. He is sure Gianni had taken the photograph which had been left by the body. Always had that camera with him. Did the police know? Had Gianni come back to town? Had Bobby Tanner come back? Was Jason next on their list? The boy Tony shot had died in the end. They had often come down from London in those days. Sometimes South London, sometimes North. Gangs looking to expand, to find soft new markets. The waitress brings his flat white with an almond biscotto. Jason still remembers the boy Tony had shot. He was only a kid. He'd offered a wrap of Coke to Steve Georgiou in the oak on the seafront. Steve Georgiou was a Cypriot lad, used to hang around on the fringes of the gang, never liked to get involved, but was loyal. Owned a gym now. Steve Georgiou had set him up. told the young drug dealer to try his luck at the Black Bridge, which the boy had done before quickly realizing his luck was out. He was bleeding a lot, Jason remembers that, and it wasn't fun, he remembers that too. Thinking back, the kid must have been about 17, which seems young now, but didn't at the time. Someone put him in Bobby Tanner's old British Telecom van, and a cabbie Tony liked to use in this sort of situation drove him out to the Welcome to Fairhaven sign on the A2102 and dumped him there. That's where they found him the next morning. Too late for the boy. He was long dead. But he'd known the risks. The cabbie got shot too because Tony thought you could never be too careful. That had been the end of things for Jason. The end of it for all of them, really. It was no longer young men making money, friends having fun, pretending to be Robin Hood or whatever he had thought it was at the time. It was bullets and dead bodies and police and grieving parents. He'd been an idiot. He'd spotted it all too late. Bobby Tanner left soon after. His younger brother, Troy, had died on a boat in the Channel. Bringing drugs in? Jason never found out. Gianni did a runner too, straight after the cabbie was shot. And that was that. Just like that. With one bullet, those days were gone. And good riddance to them. They say two brothers from St. Leonard's now run things in Fairhaven. Good luck to them, thinks Jason, still keeping it locally sourced. He walks over to the fireplace, then crouches. Yep, this was the place, all right. He runs his finger across the reproduction antique tiles. Take them off, keep scraping, and you'd find a little hole Mickey Lansdowne had filled in and painted over 20-odd years ago. The one bullet had changed everything. There was nothing left here now in the Black Bridge, with its memories and with its green tea and ginseng. All the gang gone. Tony Curran, Mickey Lansdowne, Jeff Goth. Where's that Cosworth with a hole now? Rusting somewhere in a field? And where was Bobby Tanner? Where was Gianni? How could he find them before they found him? Jason sits back down and sips his flat white. Well, he supposes. He probably knows the answer to that. Has known it all along. Jason sighs, dips his biscotto into his flat white, and calls his dad. Chapter 68. I got the photo on the Tuesday morning, says Jason Ritchie, hand-delivered through the letterbox. Father and son are drinking from bottles of beer on Ron's balcony. And you recognised it? Asks Ron. Well, not the photo. I'd never seen the photo before, but I recognised what it was, where it was, all that, says Jason. And what was it? And where was it? And all that? Asks his dad. Jason takes out the photograph and shows it to Ron. Here is Tony Curran, Bobby Tanner and me. The three of us around the table in the Black Bridge. That's where we used to drink, remember? I took you there once when you came down. Ron nods and looks at the photo. In front of the little gang, the table is covered in cash. Thousands. 25 grand maybe, all in notes just scattered about. And the boys all looking pleased about it. Where was the money from? Asks Ron. That time? No idea. It was one evening out of many. But drugs? Asks his dad. Drugs. Always in those days, confirms Jason. That's where I put my money, to keep it safe. Ron nods and Jason holds out his palms. No defence. And the police have got the photo? Asks Ron. Yep. They've got plenty more on me too. You know I've got to ask, Jason. Did you kill Tony Curran? Jason shakes his head. I didn't, Dad. And I'll tell you if I did, because you know there'd have been a good reason if I had.
Ron nods. Can you prove you didn't do it?
If I can find Bobby Tanner or Gianni, then I reckon.
It's one of them.
I can understand someone else leaving the photo by the body, you know, red herring for the cops to find, but why send it to me too? Unless Bobby or Gianni want me to know they did it.
And you're not talking to the police?
You know me. I thought I'd find them myself. And how's that going?
Well, that's why I'm here, isn't it, Dad?
Ron nods.
I'll call Elizabeth.
Chapter 69. Donna and Chris are in Fairhaven Police Station, interview suite B. Not so long ago, Donna had been sitting in this interview room talking to someone pretending to be a nun. She now sat in front of a man pretending to be a priest. The parallel was not lost on her. Donna herself had made the breakthrough. Just a few background checks on Father Matthew Mackey. Run him through the computer, see what popped up. The background checks had taken a couple of days because nothing at all had popped up, which had made no sense at all. So Donna had spent a bit of time piecing it together, working out what was what, before taking the information to Chris. And now, here they all were. At every step of the process, Mr. Mackey, Chris continues, at every step you referred to yourself as father. You introduced yourself as father.
Yes, agrees Matthew Mackey.
Even now, you're wearing a dog collar. Are we agreed?
I am, yes.
Mackey fingers the dog collar in confirmation.
And the rest, the full kit, if you like.
The vestments, yes.
And yet, when we start looking into you, what do we find, do you think?
Donna watches and learns. Chris is being gentle with the old man. She wonders if he will turn, given what they know.
I think, perhaps, possibly there may have been a misapprehension.
Chris sits back and lets Matthew Mackey talk, which he does in fits and starts.
For which I accept my share of the blame, and if you feel I have fallen short, I suppose, in some way, my intentions were not to mislead, but I see that that's how it might look without all the, facts.
The facts, Mr. Mackey, says Chris.
Excellent. Let's get on to the facts. You are not Father Matthew Mackey. That's a fact. You do not work for the Catholic Church or any church. That's another one. You are, and this has taken a full 15 minutes of research with the local NHS Trust, Dr. Michael Matthew Noel Mackey. Can we have that one as a fact too?
Yes, admits Matthew Mackey.
You retired from private practice as a GP 15 years ago. You live in a bungalow in Bexhill and, asking around there, you don't even attend Mass.
Matthew Mackey looks to the floor. All facts?
Mackey nods without looking up.
All facts.
I wonder if you could remove the dog collar for me, Mr. Mackey.
Mackey looks up and directly at Chris.
No, I'll keep it on if you don't mind, unless I'm under arrest, which you haven't mentioned.
Now Chris nods. He looks over at Donna, then turns back and drums his fingers on the table. Here we go, thinks Donna. It takes a lot to get Chris to drum his fingers on a table.
A man just died, Mr. Mackey, says Chris.
And you and I watched it happen, didn't we?
And do you know what I thought I saw?
I thought I saw a man pushing a Catholic priest.
A Catholic priest protecting a Catholic graveyard. And as a police officer, that painted things in a certain light for me.
You understand? Mackie nods. Donna is staying quiet. There is nothing she can think to add. She wonders if Chris would ever drum his fingers on a table at her. She hopes not. But what did I actually see? I actually saw a man pushing someone impersonating a priest, for reasons still known only to himself. Pushing a con man, which is what you are. A con man? Protecting a graveyard? I am not a con man, says Matthew Mackie. Chris holds up a hand to stop him. Moments after scuffling with this con man, the first man drops down dead from a lethal injection, which puts a different complexion on things, especially when we discover the con man is a doctor. But perhaps I've missed something? Mackie remains silent. I'm just going to ask you again, sir. I wonder if you could remove the dog collar for me? I'm not presently a father, I grant you that, says Mackie with a long sigh. But I was, and for many years, and that confers privileges, and this collar is one. If I choose to wear it, and if I still choose to call myself Father Mackie, then that is my business. Dr. Mackie, says Chris, this is a murder case. I need you to stop lying to me. P.C. De Freitas here has been through every record. The church has been very helpful. Whatever you've said to us, whatever you said to the council, to Ian Ventham, to the ladies who protected the gate, you are not a priest and you never were a priest. There is no record anywhere, no dusty ledger, no old photo. I have no idea why you are lying to us, but we have ourselves a dead body and we're looking for a murderer, so it's probably best that we find out quickly. If I'm missing something important, I need you to tell me. Mackie looks at Chris for a moment, thinking, then shakes his head. Only if you arrest me, replies Mackie. Otherwise, I'd like to go home now, and no hard feelings. I know you are doing your job. Matthew Mackie crosses himself and stands. Chris stands too. I would stay, Dr. Mackie, if I were you. The moment you charge me, I promise I will, says Mackie. But in the meantime... Donna stands and opens the interview room door for him. And Matthew Mackie takes his leave. Chapter 70. It can be very hard to smoke in a sauna, but Jason Ritchie is giving it his best shot. Are you sure you're okay with this, Dad? He asks, sweat dripping from his brow. Just tell him everything, replies Ron. They'll know what to do. And... you reckon they'll find them? Asked Jason. I should have thought so, says Ibrahim, stretched out on a lower bench. The sauna door opens and Elizabeth and Joyce enter, with towels wrapped around swimsuits. Jason puts out his cigarette in a pile of hot ash. Well, this is nice, says Joyce. Eucalyptus. Nice to see you, Jason, says Elizabeth, taking a seat opposite the half-naked boxer. I believe you think that we might be of use to you. I must say I agree. That's it for pleasantries. Elizabeth fixes her eyes on Jason. So? Jason tells Elizabeth and Joyce the same story he told his dad. A copy of the photo is passed around the sauna. Ibrahim has had it laminated. I get the photo, confirms Jason, and I'm like, what's this about? Where's this from? Is this the papers? Is this the front page of the Sun tomorrow? That's what I was thinking. But there's no message, nothing. There's no journalist on the phone, and they've got a number for me, so what's up? And what was up? Asks Elizabeth. Well, I'm thinking, do I ring my PR?
Maybe they've spoken to her. I was in shock, to be fair. This is 20-odd years ago, this photo, and a world I've left behind. So I'm ready to deny whatever or come up with something, stag do, fancy dress, anything to explain it away. Ooh, that's good, says Joyce. So there I am, still looking at this picture, and something clicks. I think, well, maybe this is the game. Maybe Tony's got hold of this photo. Famous boxer, surrounded by cash, jailbirds everywhere. He sends me a copy, looking for a bit of money. Give me 20K, whatever, and I don't go to the papers. Fair enough, really. So I think, yeah, I should just ring him, have a little chat. See if we can work something out. Was Tony Curran the sort of man who might blackmail you? Asks Elizabeth. Tony's the sort of man who might do anything, yeah. So first things first, I get hold of a new phone, cheap one, in town. Afterwards, will you tell me where? Because I'm looking for one at the moment, says Ibrahim. Of course, Mr. Arif, says Jason. So I ring him once and no answer. I ring him again, same. Leave it 20 minutes and try again. He's still not picking up. I never pick up if it's a number I don't recognise, says Joyce. I saw that on Rogue Traders. Very wise, Joyce, continues Jason. Then I came here for a quick drink with Pops and I saw the man himself, Curran, arguing with Ventham. Keeping all this quiet from me, says Ron. And Jason raises his hand to acknowledge it. So, after me and Dad had a couple of beers. And me, says Joyce. And Joyce, agrees Jason. After that, I went for a little drive just to do a bit of thinking. Then I headed down there, Tony's house, lovely place. Now, we're always cautious around each other, me and Tony. Too many secrets, but I wouldn't be at his front door without a reason. His car's on the drive, so when there's no answer, I think he's seen me on his security and doesn't fancy a chat, and I don't blame him. So I rang the bell a few more times and then I left. And this was the day he died? Asks Joyce. The day he died. I couldn't hear anything from inside, so I don't know if that was before or after or whatever. Anyway, home I go, and a couple of hours later, I'm on this WhatsApp group. A WhatsApp group? Asks Elizabeth, but Joyce waves her away and Jason continues. A few of the old faces, and someone says Tony's been found dead at home. I go cold, you know? I get sent the photo that morning and Tony dies that afternoon, which leaves me worried. I mean, I can look after myself, but Tony could look after himself too and see where that got him. So I'm nervous, that's natural. And then the police get wind that I've been to Tony's and they get records saying I've rung Tony's phone that day too. And they've got a photo of me that was left by the body. You can't blame them. They think that stinks, and so would I. But you didn't kill Tony Curran, asks Elizabeth. No, not me, says Jason. But you can see why the police think I did. Their case is compelling, says Ibrahim. And you're here to see if we can find your old friend for you, asks Elizabeth. Well, says Jason, the way my dad tells it, however good the police are, you lot are better. There are quiet nods all round. And it's old friends, says Jason. There's the lad who took the photo too. And who was that? Asked Elizabeth. Turkish Gianni, the fourth member of our little gang. And he's Turkish? Asked Joyce. No, says Jason. Ibrahim notes this down. He's Turkish Cypriot and scarpered back there years ago. I know some good operatives in Cyprus, says Elizabeth. Look, says Jason, you owe me nothing less than that. I've done nothing good here and Tony never did. But if Bobby or Gianni killed Tony, then they're still out there. And if they're still out there, then why not me next? Again, not your business, I know. But Dad thought it might be up your street and I'm not going to turn down the help.
So, what do you reckon? Ron asks.
Well, says Elizabeth, here's my take. The others might disagree, though I suspect they won't. This is a mess of your own making, and a mess that came from greed and from drugs, and those are downsides for me. But there is an upside too, and that is that you are Ron's son. And I believe you are probably right. I believe we can find Bobby Tanner and Turkish Gianni for you, probably quickly. And whatever you've done and whatever we might think of that, I would like to catch a murderer before that murderer catches you.
Agreed, says Joyce.
Agreed, says Ibrahim. Thank you, says Jason.
Thank you, adds Ron.
Not at all, says Elizabeth, standing. Now, I will leave you to your sauna. I have to make a few calls. Ron, I need to see you at the graveyard at 10 this evening if you're free. Joyce and Ibrahim, I'll need you there too.
Sounds lovely. Wouldn't miss it, says Ron. His son gives him a questioning look.
And Jason, says Elizabeth.
Yeah? Says Jason.
If this is a bluff, it's a high-risk one, because we will catch this murderer, even if it's you.
Chapter 71.
Do you need a hand to get down into the grave? Asks Ibrahim.
Yes, please, says Austin. That would be terribly kind of you.
Bogdan has borrowed an arc light, and it is trained on the grave he had opened on the morning that Ian Ventham was murdered. The grave that had revealed an extra occupant on top of the coffin, a skeleton buried where it had no right to be buried.
Austin holds onto Ibrahim's arm and takes a step down into the grave. He is careful not to step on the bones scattered on the lip of the coffin. He looks up at Elizabeth and chuckles.
This takes me back, Lizzie. Remember Leipzig?
Elizabeth smiles. She certainly does remember. Joyce also smiles because she has never heard Elizabeth called Lizzie before. She wonders if the others caught it.
What do you think, Prof?
Asks Ron, sitting happily at the feet of our Lord Jesus Christ and drinking from a can of Stella.
Well, I wouldn't ordinarily like to say, replies Austin, raising his glasses to get a closer look at the femur he is now holding. But if I were a gossip, among friends, of course, I would say these have been down here some while.
Some while, Austin? Asks Elizabeth.
I would say so, considers Austin, just by the coloration.
And if you were being more specific, asks Elizabeth.
Well, goodness, says Austin. If you want me to be specific, I would say...
He takes a moment to calibrate his thoughts. I would say really quite some while indeed.
So they could have been buried at the same time as Sister Margaret? Asks Joyce.
What's the date on the headstone? Asks Austin.
1874, reads Joyce.
Oh, not a chance. 30, 40, 50 years, perhaps, depending on the soil, but not 150.
So at some point, says Ibrahim, somebody has dug up this grave, buried another body in it, and then filled it in again.
Certainly, agrees Austin.
You have yourselves a mystery.
Another nun, perhaps, Austin, asks Elizabeth.
Any jewellery down there? Any fragments of clothing?
Not a thing on this one, says Austin. Stripped bare.
If it was murder, then someone knew what they were doing. I'm going to take a few bones with me, if you don't mind. I'll have a little look at them in the morning, just to give you a clearer picture. Absolutely, Austin, take your pick, says Elizabeth. Bogdan blows out his cheeks. So, we got to tell police now. Oh, I think we can probably keep this to ourselves until Austin gets back to us, replies Elizabeth, if everyone agrees. Everyone agrees. Someone give me a hand out of the grave, says Austin. Bogdan, old chap. Bogdan nods, but seems to want to get something clear first. Listen, I just need to say one thing, is okay? In case maybe I go mad. This is not normal, right? An old man in a grave looking at bones. Someone is murdered maybe, but no one tells the police. Bogdan, you didn't tell the police when you first dug up the bones, says Joyce. Yes, but I am me, says Bogdan. I am not normal. Well, we're us, says Joyce, and we're not normal either. Although I did used to be. Normal is an illusory concept, Bogdan, adds Ibrahim. Bogdan, trust us, says Elizabeth. We just want to find out whose these remains might be and who buried them, and that will be a lot easier without the police poking their noses in until absolutely necessary. If the police have the bones first, you can bet that will be the last we hear about them, and that seems unfair after all our hard work. I trust you, says Bogdan, then screws up his face as a thought occurs. Though, if it goes wrong, I bet it's me sent to prison. I won't let that happen. You're too useful, says Elizabeth. Now, please help Austin out of the grave and grab those bones for me. I suggest we all go back to Joyce's for a nice cup of tea. Splendid, says Austin, placing his selection of bones on the lip of the grave before reaching out for Bogdan's arms. You lead the way, Lizzie, says Ron, and finishes off his can of Stella. Chapter 72. Joyce. There was a jolly atmosphere, and I can understand the reason why. We each of us understand we're in a gang, and we understand we are in the middle of something unusual. We understand also, I think, that we are doing something illegal. But we are past the age of caring. Perhaps we are raging against the dying of the light, but that is poetry, not life. There will be other reasons I have missed out, but I know on the walk back down the hill we felt giddy, like teenagers out too late. But when Austin laid the pile of bones on my dining table, while we still knew it was an adventure, I think they began to have a sobering effect on all of us. Even Ron. It is all very well, the Thursday Murder Club and all our daring do, and the freedom of age and whatever we like to tell ourselves. But someone had died, however long ago it might have happened, so it was right to pause for reflection. There was no way around it. We couldn't conjure a single good reason why the extra body was there. On closer inspection, fueled by orange drizzle cake, Nigella, Austin was fairly sure that the body was a man, so it wasn't a nun. But who was he? And who had killed him? The first step to finding out the answers would be to discover when he had been killed. 30 years ago? 50 years ago? There was a big difference. Austin explained he would take the bones away and do further tests. After everybody had left, I googled him and it turns out he is a sir. I can't say I was surprised. He really did know a great deal about bones.
Quite what he made of standing in a grave at 10 at night in his 80s is his business, but I suppose any friend of Elizabeth is probably used to these things. 3 sugars in his tea, too, though you wouldn't know by looking at him. And then the biggest question of all, of course. You'll be ahead of me here. Had the motive been found for 1 much more recent murder? Did someone else know the bones were hidden there? Was Ian Ventham killed to protect the Garden of Eternal Rest and the secret of those bones? We talked for around an hour, I suppose. Were we right not to involve the police? We will have to tell them eventually, but the feeling was that this was our story, our graveyard, our home, and just for the time being, we wanted to keep it for ourselves. As soon as we get the results from Austin, we will have to tell all, of course. So, we are trying to solve 2 murders, and possibly 3, if the skeleton was murdered. Or, I should say, if the skeleton is of someone who was murdered. Is a skeleton a person? That's a question for greater minds than mine. I know Elizabeth is keen to track down Bobby and Gianni, but we all agreed the bones have to take precedence for now. I wonder if Chris and Donna are making any progress. We certainly haven't heard if they are. I do hope they're not keeping anything from us. Chapter 73. Chris and Donna are walking the 3 flights of stairs up to Chris's office. Donna has pretended to be frightened of lifts to force Chris to walk. So, Jason Ritchie for the Tony Curran murder, says Chris, and Matthew Mackey for Ian Ventham. Unless we're missing something, says Donna. I wouldn't put that past us, says Chris, so let's work it through. We know Matthew Mackey was there, and we know he's a liar. He's a doctor, not a priest. So we know he could get hold of fentanyl and he'd know how to use it, says Donna. Agreed, says Chris. I think we've got everything except a motive. Well, he doesn't want the graveyard moved, says Donna. Is that enough? Not enough to arrest him, unless we find out why he doesn't want it moved. Is impersonating a priest a crime? Asked Donna. Someone I met on Tinder once pretended he was a pilot and tried to grope me outside an All-Bar-1. I bet he regretted that. I punched him in the balls, then called in his reg number and got him breathalyzed on the way home. They both smile. But the smiles are fleeting. Both know they are in danger of letting Matthew Mackey slip between their fingers. No evidence whatsoever. Have you heard anything from your pals in the Thursday Murder Club? Asks Chris. Not a peep, says Donna. Which makes me nervous. Me too, says Chris. And I really don't want to be the one to tell them about Jason Ritchie. Chris pauses for a moment on the landing, pretending to think, but really just to catch his breath. Perhaps Mackie's got something buried in the graveyard, says Chris. Doesn't want it dug up. Good place to bury something, agrees Donna. Chapter 74, Joyce. Have you ever used Skype? I hadn't until this morning, and now I have. Ibrahim set it up, and so we had gone round to his. He keeps his flat so clean, and I don't think he has anyone in to do it. There are files everywhere, but all locked away so you can see them but not read them. Imagine the stories you must hear if you're a therapist. Who did what to who? Or is it whom did what to who? Either way, I bet he's heard all sorts. Austin rang at 10 on the dot, as you would expect from a sir, and told us what he knew. We could see him on screen, and we took it in turns to go in the little box in the corner. It was hard because the box is very small, but I expect you get used to it if you do it a few times. The body was a man, which he'd already told us. He had a gunshot wound to the femur. Austin held it up to show us. We all tried to get in the box for that bit. Had that been the wound that killed him? Austin wouldn't like to say for certain, but probably not. A pre-existing injury. At one point, his wife walked past in the background. What must she think? Her husband holding up bones to a computer screen. Perhaps she is used to it. Now, how much do you know about how to tell how old bones are? I knew nothing, and Austin went through the whole thing in detail. It was fascinating. There was a machine, and there was a special dye, and something to do with carbon. I tried to remember this all the way home so I could write it down, but I'm afraid it's gone. But it was very interesting. He would be very good on the One Show if they ever needed it. He'd taken some soil with him too and done tests on that, but the soil stuff was less interesting. Back to the bones, please, I had been thinking. The long and short of it, though, is that Austin had done some maths, and you can't be certain, and there were variables, and no one has all the answers, and all he could really do was make his best guess. At this point, Elizabeth told him to stop prattling on and get to it. Elizabeth can get away with that sort of thing, even to a sir. So he came out with it. The body was buried sometime in the 1970s, probably earlier rather than later, so 50-odd years ago, give or take. We thanked Austin, but then no one knew how to hang up. Ibrahim tried for a while, and you could see he was losing face. In the end, Austin's wife came to the rescue, his end. She seems lovely. So, there we had it. Two potential murders 50 years apart. Plenty to chew on for everyone there, and probably time to tell Chris and Donna what we have done. I hope they don't take it too personally. Elizabeth then asked if I would like to go to a crematorium in Brighton with her today, on a hunch, but I had already said that I would cook lunch for Bernard, so nothing doing. I know you can't smell it, but I'm making him steak and kidney. He is getting thin, so I'm just seeing what I can do. Chapter 75. Donna and Chris are waiting for their free coffee at the Wild Bean Cafe inside the BP garage on the A21. Anything to get out of the station for half an hour, to stop looking at the endless files from the Irish passport office. Chris picks up a chocolate bar. Chris, you don't need that, says Donna. Chris gives her a look. Please, says Donna. Let me help. I know it's hard. Chris nods and puts the chocolate bar back. So, what's in it for Mackie? Asks Donna. What's the connection with the graveyard? Why protect it if he's not a priest? Chris shrugs. Perhaps it's just a way of getting to Ventham? Perhaps there's another connection between them. Have we looked at Dr. Mackie's patient lists? You never know. Chris then picks up a cereal bar. That's even worse than a chocolate bar, says Donna. Even more sugar. Chris puts it back down. He's going to be forced to eat a piece of fruit at this rate. He's dodgy as hell, says Chris. All we're missing is his motive. Donna's phone buzzes and she reads a message. She purses her lips and looks up at Chris. It's Elizabeth. She wonders if we might like to pop over this evening. I think that might have to wait, says Chris. Tell her we're busy solving two murders. Donna continues to scroll through the message. She says she has something for us. I quote, please do not read another file until you have seen what we have found. Also, there will be sherry. See you at 8. Donna puts her phone in her pocket and looks at her boss. Well? She asks. Well? Chris slowly strokes his stubble and considers the Thursday Murder Club. He has to face it, he likes them.
He's happy drinking their tea, eating their cake and chatting off the record. He likes their rolling hills and their big sky. Was he being taken advantage of? Well, almost certainly, but for now, he was getting plenty in return. Would this all look very bad if it came out? Yes, but it won't. And if it did, why not just take Elizabeth into his disciplinary hearing and let her work her magic? Eventually, he looks up at Donna, who has her eyebrows raised, waiting for an answer. I'm a reluctant yes.
Chapter 76. Now, we can do this one of two ways, says Elizabeth. You can kick up a fuss and curse us to the heavens and we can waste a lot of time, or you can just accept what has happened and we can enjoy our sherry and get on with this. Your choice. Chris cannot speak for a moment. He looks at the four of them, then to the air, then to the floor, looking for words that don't want to come. He holds the flat of a palm in the air in front of him in an effort to pause reality for the briefest of moments, but no luck. You, he begins slowly, you dug up a body? Well, technically we didn't dig it up, says Ibrahim. But a body was dug up, yes, says Chris. Elizabeth and Joyce nod. Elizabeth takes a sip of her sherry. That's the long and short of it, confirms Joyce. And you then performed a forensic analysis on the bones? Well, again, not us personally, and only on some of them, says Ibrahim. Oh, that's fine then. Just a few? Chris's voice is raised, and Donna realizes it's the first time she's experienced this. Then I wish you all a good evening. Nothing to see here. I knew you'd get melodramatic, says Elizabeth. Can we just get this over with and move on to business? Donna steps in. Melodramatic? She addresses Elizabeth directly. Elizabeth, you just dug up a human body and failed to report it to the police. This isn't pretending to be a nun who's had her bag stolen. What nun? Asks Chris. Nothing, says Donna quickly. This is a serious crime, Elizabeth. You could all go to jail for this. Nonsense, says Elizabeth. Far from nonsense, says Chris. What on earth are you doing? I need you to think very carefully about what you say next. Why did you dig up the body? Let's take this step by step. Well, as I stated previously, we didn't dig up the body, but our attention was drawn to the fact that a body had been dug up, says Ibrahim. And we were curious, naturally, says Ron. Our attention was grabbed, agrees Ibrahim. What with the murder of Ian Ventham, adds Joyce, it seemed it might be important. You didn't think Donna and me might have been interested at this point? Asks Chris. Firstly, Chris, it's Donna and I, says Elizabeth. And secondly, who knew what the bones were? We didn't want to waste your time until we knew for sure what we were dealing with. What if we'd called you out and they were nothing but cow bones? Wouldn't we have looked silly old fools then? We wouldn't have wanted to waste your time, agrees Ibrahim. We know you are busy with two murders already. But off they went for analysis, continues Elizabeth. And back it comes. Human bones, good to have it confirmed, no cost to the taxpayer. Male, died sometime in the 1970s, a gunshot wound to the leg, but no way of telling if that's what killed him. Now, to invite Chris and Donna to take a look and to lead things from here. Get the professionals in. It really feels like you might be thanking us. Chris is trying to compose a response. Donna decides that this one might be her responsibility. Christ, Elizabeth, just give it a rest for one second,
You can drop the act with us. The second you dug up that body, you knew they were human bones, because I think you can tell the difference. Joyce, you were a nurse for 40 years. Do you know the difference between human bones and cow bones?
Well, yes, admits Joyce.
The second you did that, Elizabeth, you and your whole gang...
We are not Elizabeth's gang, interrupts Ibrahim.
Donna raises her eyebrows at Ibrahim, who holds up a hand in concession. She continues. The lot of you, from that moment, were in deep, deep trouble. This is not a neat little trick. You might fool the rest of the world, but you don't fool me. You're not plucky underdogs or helpful amateurs. This is a serious crime. This is bigger than a serious crime. And this doesn't end with us all giggling over a glass of sherry. It ends in a courtroom. How could you be so stupid? The four of you. We're friends and you treat me like this.
Elizabeth sighs.
Well, this is exactly what I meant, Donna. I knew you'd both make a fuss.
A fuss? Says Donna incredulously.
Yes, a fuss, says Elizabeth. And I do understand in the circumstances.
Just doing your job, agrees Ron.
Admirable, if you want my opinion, adds Ibrahim.
But the fuss ends here, says Elizabeth. If you're going to arrest us, arrest us. Take the four of us to the station. Question us all night. Get the same answer all night.
No comment, says Ron.
No comment, says Ibrahim.
Like on 24 hours in police custody, says Joyce.
You don't know who dug the body up and you won't hear the answer from any of us, continues Elizabeth. You don't know who took the bones away for analysis and you won't hear that from us either. At the end of the evening, you might try and explain to the CPS that four people in their 70s and 80s have failed to report digging up a body.
For what reason? With what evidence other than the inadmissible confession you've taken from us this evening?
And with four suspects, all of whom are quite happy to go to court, smile happily and pretend to mistake the judge for their granddaughter and ask why she doesn't visit often enough. The whole process is difficult, costly and time-consuming and achieves nothing. No one is going to prison, no one is getting a fine, no one's even going to be picking litter by the roadside.
Not with my back, says Ron.
Or, continues Elizabeth, you can forgive us and believe us when we say we were trying to help. You can let us apologise for our over-enthusiasm, because we did know what we were doing was wrong, but we did it anyway. We know you've spent the last 24 hours in the dark, and we know we are in your debt. And if you forgive us, then tomorrow morning, on a wild hunch, you can order a search of the Garden of Eternal Rest. You can dig up the body. You can send it to your own forensics team, who will tell you it's a male who was almost certainly buried in the early 1970s, and then we'll all happily be on the same page.
There is a moment's silence.
So, asks Chris very slowly, you've reburied the bones?
We thought it was best, says Joyce, to give you the glory.
I'd leave the grave in the top right-hand corner till about fourth or fifth if I were you, says Ron. Don't want to make it too obvious.
And in the meantime, continues Elizabeth, we can all have a nice evening and no more shouting. We can tell you everything we know, so you can really hit the ground running in the morning.
You could even share a bit of information with us, if you thought that was appropriate, adds Ibrahim.
How about some information about the custodial sentences you can get for perverting the course of justice?
Or disturbing a grave, says Chris, up to 10 years, if you're interested.
Oh, we just went through all this, Chris, sighs Elizabeth. Stop grandstanding and swallow your pride. And besides, we're